I've heard you all do that a lot, and I'm still surprised by it. There's something wondrous about that, but it is so unique, I guess. Oh, my gosh. Well, I had several people ask me how I met my wife, and we met in grad school seminary. We were strictly platonic friends for a year and a half, and maybe the best platonic friendship I ever had. And at some point, I thought, I wonder what it would be like to date Mindy. And my first thought was, oh, don't do that, because you are going to screw up a great friendship. I was in the process of having my dating life refabricated, let me just put it that way, from my first few years in college. But a month later, I got some counsel about it from Harold, and about a month later, I asked her out, and we had probably the most underwhelming first date in the history of mankind. So it's February in Texas, and it's cold, and I invited her to go on a picnic. It snowed that day. And so instead of going there, I really didn't know what to do. Well, there was a Luby's cafeteria that probably doesn't even exist. Has anybody ever heard of Luby's? You know Luby's cafeteria. Okay, Luby's cafeteria is close to being your elementary school cafeteria, where you go and you get the tray, and you just kind of walk down the tray, and you tell the lady what you, yeah, I put the green beans in this tray, and the corn here, and the salad here, And in a modern day Luby's at my age, I would be one of the youngsters of Luby's cafeteria. We had a nice lunch. I took her back to the dorm, the women's dorm, walked her up. She walked inside. And the next day I realized she didn't know that was a date. Ponder that for underwhelming. So as we're talking, the students said, I said, no, that was a date. She said, it was? I said, yes. Are you sure? I said, yes, I want to date you. She said, you do? I said, yes. Are you game? She thought for a few moments and she said, giddy up. So I thought, okay, for date number two, I mean, you know, at such a low hurdle, certainly anything can be better. So I decided I was going to take Mindy sailing. I had learned to sail my senior year in college, absolutely loved sailing, and I thought, oh, what a great second date. So we drove 90 miles from Fort Worth down to Waco, pulled into the parking lot, went down and got the sailboat, motored out through the marina, with the wind, breeze, the birds chirping, the white fluffy clouds, so the Brazos River, and we were downstream, downwind, just having a delightful conversation. And at some point I thought, well, you know, Seth, it's been almost 2 years since you sailed. You probably shouldn't get that far away from the marina. And so I decided to turn the boat around to tack upstream against the stream and against the wind. And as I was trying to tack across the river, instead of going upstream, we were moving sort of more downstream. I thought, this is not what's supposed to happen. I went all the way across the river, hoping that things would change. It didn't. And before we ran into the bank and the trees, I turned the sailboat downstream, downwind, and tried to come across this way and lean that sail over a little bit more, trying to get more wind to bite in that sail and bite that boat and force it to tack. And the same thing was happening. We were slowly moving downstream away from the marina. And I'm thinking, dang, what am I missing? What am I missing? Turned the boat a second time to go across the river, the third time to try to tack, and I turned the boat, got the boat a little bit too far over for the wind, and suddenly we got a gust of wind, and it blew the sail right down into the water. She goes flying out of the water. I'm watching her flying through the air, and I just hear, ah! And the boat went completely upside down. Sail completely down. Now, I'm under the water, and while I'm under the water, I'm thinking, okay, I know what to do. When you come up, you grab a hold of the centerboard so you can get leverage to prop the boat back up. Well, when I popped back out of the water to grab the centerboard, I realized why we weren't making any progress in tacking. Somebody had forgot to put the centerboard in the sailboat. There was no chance of us going upwind or upstream without that. And I thought, how am I going to turn this boat back upright? So we are bobbing down the river, and I am going down and under the water, trying to untie the knots that were holding the sail out so I could collapse the sail and hopefully get it back upright. That took a while, but finally did. And thankfully, God sent an angel. It was a little fisherman guy with one of those little silver Texas boats, and he came along and he fished Mindy out of the water and tied a little rope to my boat and towed me back to the marina. This is date number. We get back to the car, and I realize the following things. It's still February in Texas, which means it's cold. And we are completely drenched with no towel and no change of clothes and a 90-mile drive back home. Date number two. Her hair was just kind of hanging down. Makeup looked like a prison camp. Halloween, you know, we might have been able to pass for that. It was just so strange. Now, I've had, and Mindy's had, college girls ask her, why did you go out with him again? And I think sometimes she said, the adventure. Well, if you are a note-taking person, let me give you three words that I would like you to walk away with today. They are the words necessary, normative, and redemptive. Necessary, normative, and redemptive. A little review. We've looked at the session one, the golden treasure, and that this is where we are meant to live, the wonder of the dance of the Trinity, and that we are included in that, and then all the treasures of Jesus and all the treasures that come with him, and we are designed to live on this side of the stage. That's our primary place. This is where our needs are met, over here on this side. First thing, pleasures. But as Christians, it's very easy for us to reduce Christianity, not to this, but to good enough Christianity. I know I'm going to heaven. I'm reading my Bible. I'm praying, trying to share my faith with people, trying to walk with God, be a good Christian, good enough. When we do that, we are turning away from the treasure. We reduce Christianity to something that takes the very heart and soul out of it. Then we looked at the golden pitcher. We are not a bowl, we are a pitcher. And the experience of God is not just me sitting home with my Bible praying, hoping God will fill up my bowl. We experience God much more realistically. I'm not saying it always feels this way, but as we are involved in the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. God fills our pitcher to whatever level he wants to at any given season of life. That's up to him. Now, what we want is, what's wrong with me that it doesn't feel full? And if God filled our pitcher up every day like we want to, we would be a mess. We would reduce Christianity to something that it's not. We would be like the people in the wilderness wanderings for 40 years. Here, what's easy to reduce Christianity to as a bowl is it's all about me and my family. Me and my family. Me and my career. Me and my job. Me and my finances. In other words, we take legitimate second things, pleasures, and we redefine them as those are the things that we're about. This is what Christianity is supposed to do for me. Then we looked at the golden key in quotation marks. Now that I'm a Christian and I have the ability to pray and the truth of God's word and fellowship and worship and all these things, that now we've dumbed down Christianity to vending machine Christianity. We know what we want. We think we know what we want. We think we know how to get it. and our world doesn't cooperate with us. Our spouse doesn't cooperate in certain moments. Our roommates don't cooperate. Our friends don't cooperate. Challenge staffers aren't meeting the need that I think I need. And we go over to the vending machine and we push A3. You know, God, please change the challenge staffer. Please change the pastor. Please wake up my spouse. Please help my teenager to appreciate what I'm doing. And we looked at Jeremiah 2:13, and for me, what I think of in that is we are idol-making machines. We will turn almost anybody or anything into, that's what I need. That's what I'm after. And God says, oh, no, 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 no. I am not going to let you do that. And here, God goes to work with trials, troubles, and suffering. And here where our three words come in. These things are necessary. They are normative, but they are redemptive. Peter says, I don't want you to be surprised by the things, the trials we're going through. And we should not be surprised when this happens to us. And there are things in your life you may have already wrestled with that stretch you beyond your ability. But certainly as you get older, you will find this to be a part of life. That these things are necessary, normative, but redemptive. Part of what I think about here as we think about what really is Christianity is I like what Soren Kierkegaard, the philosopher, said. He said, our tendency is to write our story as if I am the star of the show and of the play, and I am the director and the producer and the writer. And the storyline, I get to pick for how it's going to play out over the course of my life. And we all sort of have an idea with our imagination of what we hope life will play out with. And then God or Jesus is sort of a bit player or almost like the assistant producer that when the story's not going like we want it to, we can call on him and say, would you do something about my story? Now, what Kierkegaard contrasts that with is Christianity, where the central star of the show is Jesus Christ. That's the treasure. And the writer and producer and director of this story is God himself. And you and I are bit players, but important players in that story. When we get this confused, we set up ourselves for a bunch of extra discouragement that didn't need to happen. Now, life is discouraging already in some ways. That's normative. We live in a fallen world with fallen people. We are fallen. Just me trying to deal with me sometimes is discouraging. So discouragement is not necessarily there's something wrong with you. That just means there's something healthy with you. You're reading the situation realistically. But we do a force multiplier on discouragement when we expect to be in Kierkegaard's first story or reduce Christianity to second thing pleasures. Well, there are three things I want to say here about this in the message about the golden crown. The first has to do with there's a strong sense in the Bible of call, that God calls us out of darkness into light. He calls us out of death into life, darkness to light, death to life. He calls us to be a part of what he's doing as a co-laborer in his fields. And there are different aspects of this call. One I think of is that you and I are cherished. This is part of our call. It's not like just God is hiring because, I mean, he does need more laborers, but it's not like he's just hiring anybody. He's hiring people he cherishes. Isaiah 43:1 has an interesting sort of weaving to me in this. Verse 1, now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, and he's speaking to the whole nation there, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. This is very personal language. It's the kind of language you would tell your kids when they're little and when they're growing up. And yet, it's easy to sort of read that and just sort of assume that, well, I guess I'm going to get special protection in this world from trouble. And somehow, maybe I'm going to get a pass on some of this stuff. Look at the next verse. When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you. Why do I have to pass through the waters anyway? Can't you do that first verse and sort of make the waters go around where I don't have to walk through troubled waters? I will be with you. And by I will be with you, in my opinion, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to feel he is with you. He is awfully determined to help us to walk by faith. And by faith, when he says, I will be with you, that's a conviction down in your gut that this is true. Whether I feel this way or not, whether it feels like he's a million miles away or right here with me, does not matter about my feelings. It's true. And because it's true, we sang about this in one of our songs. I have a foundation that I stand on. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. Now, I am intrigued by the word overwhelm you. There are times in life where you feel overwhelmed. Your back is up against the wall. You don't know what you're going to do. This is a big mess. I don't know how I'm going to extricate myself. I don't know how this can happen. Life sometimes feels overwhelming. If you want a good example of that from a godly man, look at 2 Corinthians 1, 3 through about verse 11. Paul, the great Paul, knew what it was like to feel overwhelmed. He says, to the point of death. Stretched as far as he could be. In other words, necessary, normative, redemptive. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flame will not consume you. And by consume, he's using metaphorical language here. He's not talking about being, you're in the paradise fire and your house got burned and you died. He's talking about something much, much greater than that. When he says, the flame shall not consume you, I think what he means is, even in the darkest nights you go through, the toughest times of suffering, your faith can stand. That cannot be a flame or burned. You will not be consumed in that sense. You can continue to walk with God no matter what. Now, notice verse 1 and verse 2 are sort of woven together. In other words, these things coexist at the same time. They are not mutually exclusive. Verse 3, I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I give Egypt as your ransom, Ethiopia and Seba in exchange for you. And here, what he's saying is, as you're going through these tough times with overwhelming waters and fire and you stretch beyond, what he's saying in verse 3 is remember. Remember what I did with Egypt when my people were in slavery for 400 years with no hope of release and even in a situation that dire. Remember what happened. Remember that story. And then he comes back to that personal, precious language, cherished, because you are precious in my eyes and honored. You hear sort of the dance of the Trinity there in this language. He means you. I love you. I give men in return for you, peoples in exchange for your life. But what he's talking about here, I think of as these are some of the examples of first thing pleasures. He's given them categories in which to remember and to think about the relationship with God. And at the same time, that suffering is necessary, normative, and redemptive. Well, we are not just cherished, but on the inside of your handout, we are also a cherisher. We looked at this with the golden pitcher. The second command, we are to love our neighbors, we love ourselves. And this is the message of the pitcher. And our role is to try to help other people get a taste of the treasure. You really are the hands of Jesus. You really are the eyes of Jesus, the countenance. You are his countenance. That people, When I'm with people, I want them to feel like I want to be with them. That doesn't happen all the time. But that's what I'm hoping for, to give them a taste of this. I like being with you. I hope that's the vibe that in talking with people, I hope that's the vibe they're getting. That's part of the picture. You are the smile of Jesus. You are the eyes of Jesus, the delight on his face. And then there's an element here of being commissioned as part of our call. David Wooster talked about Sunday night, two messages on Monday. That's part of the role of the pitcher, is we care about lost people. And then the last thing I think about is sort of an interesting caricature here, almost a dichotomy when it comes to God's call. Because on one hand, Philippians 3, 12 to 15 talks about that we are on the upward call of God. And I remember as a younger Christian, assuming that what that meant was, is that my life was going to be progressively getting better and better and more mature and less having to deal with temptations. The upward call of God, straining forward to what lies ahead, forgetting what is behind. And yet, in 1 Peter 2, there's a very different call that he talks about here. What credit is it when you do wrong and are beaten for it, you take it patiently? But if when you do right and suffer for it, you take it patiently, you have God's approval. Now, what we'd all like to do is rewrite that verse. If when you do right and suffer for it, God's going to figure out a way to get your needs met over here. God's going to intervene. And sometimes he does intervene in our trials and troubles. I'm thankful for that. But sometimes he points us in a different direction. You have God's approval, meaning when this happens to you, there are times you need to turn back to first thing pleasures and to the treasure. God's approval. God's approval. For to this you have been called. This kind of suffering, necessary, normative, redemptive. Do not be surprised, my brothers, when these things come upon you. We have several sort of, I think about our meaning in a couple different categories in this context. We have a meaning we talked about simply because we are a part of we know the treasure, the wonder of grace, the dance of the Trinity. Just that by itself gives us tremendous meaning. But the meaning that we derive is when we pick up the pitcher and when we are involved engaging with other people. And that's through God's call to us, his call. Okay. Second thing is there's a cost here on this particular this message, the golden crown. I am willing to pay any price to reveal God. Now, this is one of those things that theoretically, as a younger Christian, I remember saying, yep, I'm willing to pay any price. And I remember talking to Harold when I was a pretty young Christian. I'd been a Christian maybe about 2 years. And I said, Harold, you know, sometimes we're in the student center. And sometimes I think that, okay, Lordship of Christ, solid. And then the other times I'm thinking, I don't know. I said, it's very confusing to me. He said, well, you can't think generally about it. You have to think specifically. For example, you're 22 years old. You're single. What if God wanted you single until you were 30? Would you be good with that? I said, yeah, be good with that. What if he wanted you single until you were 40? That would be a different story. How about 50? How about 70? What if he wanted you single all your life? And the question just sort of hung in the air, and then he said, would you rejoice in it? Now, I can tell you that that began a process here of willing to pay a higher cost as I got older. That just didn't happen magically sitting in the student center at that table. I realized there was a disconnect between what I thought I was willing to pay and what, oh my gosh, I haven't been tested. Seth, you're going to be pastoring some. What if God wanted you out in the middle of the New Mexico desert in a small little town, a little church, until you were 30? I'll do that. What if you wanted there till you were 40? 50? 70? Would you rejoice in it? Now, I could tell just by the nature of my response that I was willing to pay some price here, but over the time, God has used trials, troubles, and some suffering to deepen that reality in my heart. It is still in process. I like what these three little examples in Luke have to do with this. As they were going along the road, a man said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus didn't pull out a clipboard and say, "Give me your contact information and we'll get back with you." He gives him a stunning response that at one level, this guy must have been absolutely dumped at it. Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Now, what is he saying? He's saying, you may think it's pretty easy to follow me, but there's a cost to it. It's not going to be pretty sometimes. It's not going to be pleasant. Sometimes we reduce Christianity to the comfortable life. That's what we're really after, the comfortable life. And he's saying, oh, no, 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 no. That's not what you're signing up for. Second guy comes. To another, he said, follow me. But the fellow said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And the idea here is something of, when I first read this years ago, I thought, well, I wonder if there was a funeral happening in 15 minutes and this poor guy needed to deal with the funeral. And don't think that's what was happening. By the nature of the response of Jesus, he is saying something very important to this guy. Leave the dead to bury their own dead. As for you, you go and proclaim the kingdom of God. Now, leave the dead, what does he mean? The people who are alive, but who are spiritually dead, lost people. Let the dead bury their own dead, meaning the people that are lost and want to stay lost will be buried by lost people. You go and proclaim the kingdom of God. The essence of what I think he's saying here to the man is you can either live by second thing pleasures as central or first thing pleasures as central. That's your choice. But this is what's involved. Then the third guy says, I will follow you, Lord, but let me first, same language as the second guy, let me first say farewell to those at my home. And again, when I first read this years ago, I thought, oh, he was getting ready to go off to college or go off to work somewhere, and the family was at home having a little going away part. That's not what is happening in this. He is saying, I think what he's saying is, let me first be the driver of my life. And God says, Jesus says to him, no, 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 no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. Meaning, you are going to endure difficulties. There's going to be a cost here. It's not easy. And you're going to ask yourself, is it really worth it to follow Jesus? What I'm going through now, what my wife and I are going through now, is this really worth it? Is the pain that we go through, is this really worth it? Now, God uses these trials and troubles and sorrow, suffering, again, as ways that are redemptive in our life. And some of the ways that I think about redemptive is that there is a redemptive process going where we are less and less expecting second thing pleasures to fill our soul instead of first thing pleasures. This is a process that goes on all our life. The other thing I think about that God is trying to reverse in me is our natural nature that says, first me, then you. Which can happen in conversations. It can happen as a way of life with your roommate, with your husband, with your wife. Anytime you have an argument, you have two first me people trying to litigate their what they want to happen with each other. Rarely do you hear somebody say, you know, you have different ideas about this that makes sense to you. I would never think about what you're saying, but it makes, tell me more about that. And you're curious and you want to know. And maybe you ask questions, not so you can litigate or debate, but because you genuinely want to know what this person, that's what God is trying to do, where it becomes first you, then me. 2 Corinthians 12:15. I will most gladly spend. Not just willing to pay a price, gladly paying a price. Gladly spend. And the second one is even tougher. Be spent. There are times when people will take advantage of you. Times when people will say awful things about you. Draw conclusions about you that aren't true. Will gossip about you. That's hard. Especially when you have given yourself to some of those very people. That's the second part of this, to be spent. I think what God is doing on this willing to pay any price reveal God is something like this. When I was a new Christian, and Harold gave me this nugget. He said, Seth, all of us have a contract with God. I think I was 22 years old at the time. An unwritten contract with God that says something like, God, I will gladly follow you as long as the following conditions are met. And then we have our list of bullet points that we may not even be aware of yet. And over the course of our life, God takes out his whiteout. Do you all know what whiteout is? Thank you. I'm glad for that. I didn't know what I was going to replace whiteout with. He takes his heavenly whiteout, and little by little, he wipes those things out over the course of our life until the contract reads, God, I will gladly follow you. Period. How do we get to that point? Part of it is through trials and trouble and suffering. This is why these things are necessary, normative, and thankfully redemptive. Well, the last part is has to do with the crown. And this is our imagery for today. And the idea of crown is I am living primarily for what only heaven can give me. Don't break the crown. You see the great mechanical ability I have here on display. There we go. Now, probably when you think of crown, you think of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we could put this over here with the Dance of the Trinity and with the, and with the treasure. But one of the most amazing things about the gospel, in spite of us still being idol-making machines every day, still rebels at heart, still a people who gravitate to second thing pleasures as primary. And we call our desires needs, and we expect people to meet those needs that only God can meet. God still says to people like us, I want to put a crown on your head someday. I find that absolutely stunning and ludicrous at some level. What? What, me? What are you talking about? And yet, this is one of the imagery that we have here. Think about Paul near the end of his life as he's writing the book of 2 Timothy, writing the letter to Timothy. He writes these words in a prison cell. It's not like he's living the comfortable life, you know, down by the Sea of Galilee. I am already in the point of being sacrificed. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Think about yourself 45 or 50 years from now. For some, maybe 10 years from now. For me, any time at my age. 40 years, 30 years from now. What is going to matter at that point in your life? When you look back on the life you lived, what do you want to be able to say? What will matter then? Well, we have Paul's example here. This is what mattered to him. And this is what's going to matter to all of us. I have fought the good fight. The good fight is something along this line. We live in a fallen world that's very difficult to navigate. We live with fallen people. Sometimes it's very annoying. And I have a great fight with me every day with my own nature. But I'm fighting. I'm still fighting. The battle's not over yet. It will be pretty soon. I have finished the race. And here the idea is, he didn't quit along the way, didn't throw in the towel. He endured, he persevered until the end and kept the faith. Meaning, not just I'm still a believer theologically, but he kept hold of the treasure. This is what he valued most. He valued a relationship with God that is grace-filled, not earned, and the enjoyment of the dance of the Trinity. That is what he held on to. Now, what I think of here is we're not yet at his age. I might be. I don't know. Gary, you might be. I don't know how old Paul was. But what strikes me here is that he's got his eye, and he wants our eye to be on the future. And we are driven, we are pulled, compelled by what's coming and what's going to matter at that day. Now, for about 20 years, I've been a triathlete. Now, if you think, I'm not an Ironman triathlete. I'm more like Gumby Man triathlete. I'm more like Plastic Man triathlete, you know. But I enjoy it when I'm done. I enjoy training when I'm done. But all of the training, I usually loathe before I put on my shoes or get on my bike or jump in the water. I just think, oh, I can't wait till this is over. But then you don't know a happier swimmer or biker or runner when I'm about 5 minutes from being done. And on the way home from a race, you don't know a happier triathlete than me. But all the while, I'm grinding, enduring, persevering, fighting to try to do this. Now, one of the strange things about triathlons is that I swim in a high school pool. And a high school pool is great. You've got your lane lines right there. And you've got that big, black, wide line that goes all the way across the pool. At the pool I swim in, sometimes you do the 25-yard pool. Sometimes they do what we call long course, the 50-meter pool. The black lines run both ways. But when you're in a lake or in the Pacific Ocean doing it, there are no black lines. And there are no lane lines. And you've got guys crawling all over you, and you're kicking some guy's head in the back, and you're getting kicked in the head in front of you, and you can see maybe 2 or 3 feet down there. You have no idea if you are swimming straight. In the ocean, you have tides and the waves and swells, and they move you all over the place. So in that kind of situation, or even in a lake, what you have to do in the swim part is you have to see, okay, where's the first buoy that we're swimming to? And then you may not be able to see the buoy while you're swimming because of so many people and so much splashing. So you look up above that to something on the hill, as highest point you can, that's on the straight line with that buoy. And then as you're swimming with all these guys around you, you're doing between 5 and 10 strokes. And then you look up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sight. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sight. All the way to the buoy. Then you make the turn, and you're going to the next buoy. The first thing you do at that moment is you find the place that you're sighting toward, and you're not looking at the buoy. You're looking at that tree or that house on a hill until you get that. That's what Paul is suggesting here that we do. There's a crown coming. Keep your sight on that. Keep your sight on the finish line, on the end of the fight. And there are a couple of things I take from this. I was designed for fulfillment. that can only be really filled in heaven. We get tastes of it here. We've had tastes of it this week at Hume Lake. We go down in the valley, these are going to be more rare moments. They're not normative. But they're meant to be redemptive, to help us recite and to keep us moving back towards the treasure. The second thing that I think about, what I long for, I cannot have fully in this life. Your capacity for enjoyment and satisfaction and fulfillment is greater than what any person or experience can pour into you now. There are times where it feels full. That's great. Enjoy that. But what God provides for us here is sort of like hors d'oeuvres. We get some taste, we've had some tasty hors d'oeuvres this week at Hume Lake. But when we go back down the hill, we are not going to have a banquet. The hors d'oeuvres are meant for us to sight forward to what's coming. There's a banquet coming. And the tastes that we have now are redemptive tastes that say to me, I can wait for what's coming. What's coming will fully satisfy me. Hebrews 11, 13 has the same idea. The people lived in this life, in this world. There's the same principle. They were not experiencing what they originally thought they were going to experience, but they had their eyes sighted on a different homeland in heaven. One of the things I appreciate about the book of, or the chapter of Hebrews 11, is that only in heaven will all the suffering and trials and troubles that we have gone through finally make sense. It won't just be rational. I think what we'll do is we'll go, oh my gosh, I never imagined that you could create something, whether it's me or somebody else, out of that horror that we went through. And we're going to watch a little video clip from Saving Private Ryan, one of my favorite movies. And it's the two scenes that we're going to look at back to back. Private Ryan is a story of the Ryan family who had five sons in World War II. Four of the sons had already died. There was one last guy, James Ryan, who was a young kid, who was still alive in Europe. And the Secretary of War sent out a command, find James Ryan wherever he is in Europe and get him home safely. And so a platoon of men are tasked with this, and it sort of begins on D-Day, and they're trying to find in this morass of millions of soldiers Private Ryan. Along the way, several of the men in that platoon are killed in this process. And they finally find Private Ryan. And Private Ryan doesn't initially want to go with them. He feels like he'd be betraying, you know, his fellow soldiers. And so Captain John Miller, which you will see Tom Hanks, is a school teacher in Pennsylvania. But he's charged with doing this. And the battle scene that we're going to just catch the general end of is that the Germans are attacking them in this town. Captain Miller, Tom Hanks, is trying to blow up the bridge so the Germans can't cross the bridge. And he's going to be wounded. And you'll see a scene here. It's a very poignant scene where Private Ryan comes up to him. And as Captain Miller is in the process of dying, he's going to whisper some words. I hate to give this away, but it's hard to hear it. He's going to say, James, earn this. Earn this. And then the second scene, which is really cool. All right, can you guys get the lights? And let's go to the video. I've probably seen that 30 times, and I cry every time like a baby. But someday, each of us are going to be standing in a similar situation just like him in old age. And you're going to look back on your life, as will I, and there are going to be things that are going to matter.